Hey, yo, we about to tear it up. Hey, yo.
Break for break, get down.
This right here is how we do it. Break it down.
It's the Breaking Atoms podcast. We break things down to the very last compound. My name is Sumit, a.k.a. the Potty Mouth of the South.
My name is Chris Mitchell, a.k.a. the Actual Factual.
Actual
Guaranteed.
Facts. Yo, this is some actual facts. We got a legend from the UK on the podcast.
Come on now.
I'm putting it out there.
Come on now.
This is someone who has worked very hard. And I said to him on the podcast, I said it to him before, I'm super proud of him. This is Beat Butcher.
Hmm.
He worked incredibly hard to get to where he's got to.
Mm.
And he ain't stopping. He
has
so much to get through. And we know. I'm just saying, listen.
I was doing the Rick Ross grind,
though. Of course. Because, you know, we didn't even talk about Maybach. You know what I mean? We didn't even talk about Maybach music.
Oh, yeah.
Deja Loaf. Listen. Let me tell you something about Butcher, right? And I'm going to say it because he may not like me saying it, but I'm going to say it. That guy has got a resume that not many people can ever have. And they
longer than the OJ trial, isn't it?
Come on, bro. This is his resume is long. His product and output is strong, and he's a nice guy. And
absolutely.
you get to hear that in this episode. But I'm just psyched that we were able to make this happen. I've known Butcher for a number of years. Obviously, I dipped in and out of music, so we was a time where I didn't speak to him for a number of years. But I'm happy for him, man. Like, it just makes me proud and happy every time I see him on the timeline. And I'm starting to make sure that people tag him when they talk about produced by.
Absolutely.
When you talk about a Conway record and it's a produced by Beat Butcher, put that shit in, right? His name deserves to be up there with everyone. So.
And it's Beat Butcher.
Yes.
With an A at the end. Butcher. Butcher.
So this is Beat Butcher, Breaking Atoms podcast. Check it out. It's another special episode of the Breaking Atoms podcast. This time we take it all the way back across the pond to the roots, to someone that we've both known for a number of years, producer extraordinaire. He can sample whatever you want and make it sound like a sample, and it's not. He can just create beats. He's on fire right now. He's produced for, I don't know, we can run the names down. We could Duckworth, there's Prodigy, there's Jay-Z, Beyonce, the Griselda crew. There's so much he's done. We're very pleased to have Beat Butcher on the podcast. How you doing, my man?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. Definitely. Listen, I'm just saying, I want to say it. I've said it to you privately and I'll say it publicly. I am so happy for you. Not that you need my happiness, but I just have to say, like, when good people win, we all win. And it's just see you have worked so hard from way back when, right? So if it's with Chemo, Brain Tax, with Jess, your journey is incredible. You've worked very hard and you deserve all the success you get. So
appreciate,
I want to say that,
man.
Publicly.
Appreciate that, bro. Trust me. Yeah, appreciate that.
So you're out in LA. How's it out there at the moment with the COVID and all that?
It seems that things are kind of opening back up again in the industry. Like, people are doing sessions again, but generally I think that, you know, there's an air of like paranoia still and everything. And, you know, restaurants are still only outside seating. But yeah, things are kind of opening up again. I mean, it's definitely, like, if I wanted to take back-to-back sessions like I was before lockdown, I could just be doing them because there's, like, the demand is there and everyone's just moving around again. So, but I'm being kind of, selective and careful of, like, who I'm... Do you know what I mean? If people have been traveling around a lot, because obviously there's been a few kind of deaths that have been close to home, you know what I mean? So, I mean, not necessarily like not family members, but, you know, in the industry or whatever, and Ty, and, you know what I'm saying? Fred the Godson. So, like, yeah, you know what I mean? Keeping that in mind or whatever.
You have to. It's crazy time. And I know, like, for a lot of artists and producers and DJs and things, that they're worried about touring and what it means. And, you know, some of them saying they won't be able to tour until 2022 and things like that. So, It's so uncertain.
I feel like, if anything, I mean, I don't, it probably wasn't the lockdown that's affected this, but, like, if anything, I feel like things have been pretty good career wise this year. So, the lockdown, I don't feel like has really affected me in that kind of way. Thankfully, like, I feel blessed about that. That's, you know what I mean? It's because it could have been, it could be, you know, terrible. You know what I mean? But people are still consuming music and people are still putting music out. So for me, as a non-touring musician, that's kind of like perfect. You know what I mean? And it feels like, I mean, this is kind of weird, but it feels like admins at labels are less likely to fuck around because they're not in the office. So they've been paying more on time. I noticed that. I got paid for a few things that haven't even come out yet. And I was like, what? That never happens.
I love it. I love it. No, that's good. You know, there's always be positives. But what's your production process like? Is it like very, like we spoke to Apollo Brown. Right. He talked to us about, like, it's very much about mood, and he, you know, takes the mood. Whereas some producers like to make music with the artist in mind. Is yours kind of mood based, or is it just how you have?
Yeah, it's mood based. I've kind of positioned myself in a way where I've got like outlets for lots of different kind of sounds and styles, and my taste is very broad. So, I literally just make whatever I feel like making, whenever I feel like making it, and then figure it out afterwards. You know what I mean? Figure out what I'm going to do with it afterwards. So I feel like going into it with this kind of whole idea of, you know, oh, I need to make a track for so-and-so, or a hit, or this is going to be a placement for so-and-so. You never make anything from an honest kind of place. So, I mean, even with the Griselda stuff, you know, like if we're working on a Griselda project or whatever, and I know that I'm meant to be making beats like that, I won't like necessarily just try and make exactly that, you know what I'm saying? I'll just try and make stuff in that tempo and with that mood. And you know, like there's been plenty of beats that came out of that weren't necessarily, you know, like maybe like I was working for trying to do some stuff for Gunn, and the beats that came out were maybe more Benny or like Conway beats, or let's say like, or like, you know, something that Evidence might use, or, you know, I don't know, like, so I think, yeah, it's definitely mood based, man. I just like to do what I like to keep the creativity free, like, and just do whatever I feel like doing when I feel like it. You know what I mean? Like that sounds a bit hippy dippy, but you know what I mean, though. Like,
no, I know. From what I know of you, you are a very free spirit. You're very creative. You're very charismatic, and I think that authenticity then comes from hearing what you're saying. That kind of authenticity goes into your production process. So you're still who you are as you're making beats. Because you're a very funny guy. You're a very funny guy.
I don't know where I really am, though, bro. Like, I'm like the most awkward motherfucker ever, bro.
Listen, I'm from the school of, like, I love Seinfeld, right? Like, I love that. Like, it's dry humor. I like sarcasm, you know. Yeah. Plus, I'm British too, right? So we got to love the dry humor.
Yeah.
But that charisma then didn't probably... in your production process comes through. And then there's some, I think you might have tweeted about it, but it's something that I think may have been in one of the Griselda documentaries as well. It's about sampling, right? So you are now creating your own samples. Like, so like Pharrell.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess that, you know, the reason they got me involved in the the Griselda stuff was because I was able to make the kind of textures that, you know, they like to sample, but then sample free, you know, stuff that I'm, you know, and I guess, you know, that's been kind of a thing that I've been doing for, I don't know, like a little bit over 10 years. Like I was still sampling, let's say 10 years ago, but I was kind of adding like elements to it, you know, the played elements and stuff to it. But basically all of that came out of kind of necessity, you know. I was trying to figure out how to make, you know, money in this music industry, doing the kind of music that we make. And I guess, you know, the thing, one thing that always comes up is like, you know, don't use any samples. Sample clearance is a headache and all this stuff. So I guess, you know, I was around a lot of people kind of early on that were doing that, you know, like Frank Dukes and stuff, and inspired heavily by, like, let's say like DJ Khalil and like Jake One and stuff. And, you know, so I just was kind of challenging myself to, like, you know, learn how to like make textures and kind of try to play instruments and stuff. You know, I'm still not the greatest musician there is, but I can get a take. I can also program. The MIDI obviously helps a lot. People are always, you know, think, oh, MIDI's has to sound, you know, it's going to sound cheap if you use MIDI or whatever, but like, there's ways around everything, man. There's ways around everything. You know what I mean? And you don't have to necessarily be like some sort of, you know, piano or guitar virtuoso to make something dope with an instrument. You know what I'm saying? But, so yeah, with basically more and more, like, I kind of focused on that. And when I was doing the trips back and forth, when I was still living in England, and I was doing the trips back and forth to the States, it kind of became a thing where it was kind of easier to make music or play the position of making music and then have some of my producer friends turn it into beats than it was to make my own beats and then, you know, have to sit there and send them around. And it became a thing where it was kind of a bit boring, like making beats was a bit boring. The more I delved into like playing stuff and, you know, just get, that kind of world is a whole new world. And it, you know, it opens up like all sorts of things that you can do creatively that sticking to a beat is very like constricting. Do you know what I'm saying? The minute you turn it into a beat, then it has like context and you know, then it's kind of restricted to, okay, who can you hear on this style, right, on this, you know? So I basically, you know, I have a lot of like producer friends, you know, Boudon Grands, V-Don, you know, those kind of dudes who I was staying with whenever I was going to New York. So I just thought, okay, well, what if I just, you know, focus on the samples and send them to them, and then that way I don't have to worry about getting the placements or getting the records. They can turn it into the music, they can turn it into the beats, and they, you know, they can figure out where it's going to go. And if, you know, if I can like get it somewhere, like that'll help too, because our collective, you know, networks are bigger than just the network of one person, you know what I'm saying? So yeah, that's kind of how I cut my teeth, but I'm kind of back on the solo beats as well now. So I really enjoy collaborating and the social aspect of music making. You know what I mean? It's important to me.
No, fair.
And it feels better winning with like friends too, you know?
No, it does. It always does. Yeah, because it's collective, and it definitely. What's the weirdest? But what's the kind of craziest sound you've ever sampled that you've then put on a beat?
Craziest. I don't know, man. I've done a lot of kind of weird things over the years. I've sampled my voice a lot. I guess. Shit, I don't know if it's really that weird, but like the Spurs 3 beat that just came out, it was on the on the Conway album. That was a kalimba. I was at Alchemist's crib, and somebody had given him this kalimba, this like kalimba, the same day, and he was like, "Oh, do you want to use this?" So I was like, "Yeah, fuck it." So I just like voice noted it, and then kind of like pitched it about. You know what's funny? Like I was sat next to Darringer when I was doing it. And I was like, sometimes I kind of make a beat out of something just to get the context. And then like, I'll say to like whoever else that I'm working with, I'll say, you know, like, do you want to do different drums on this? This is what I'm kind of hearing. Like, what do you think? And I guess he might've not been feeling that what I did. And then, or he was like, yeah, the drums sound good at how you have them. So I just decided to keep it like that. But, yeah, sampling weird things. I don't know, man. Like I sample everything, bro.
I can imagine. That's why I asked. The reason why I ask is I can imagine you might hear a certain sounding a cool, like, because my brain's not like yours, right? So I don't have that. But you could sample anything, and then you could either put a certain different swing on it or a compressor on it, and something that could just change it that makes a sound. Like you could. I don't know. You could, because I remember watching a documentary, like the Thriller documentary. Where the engineer in the studio would just make different sounds to get the drums in and do it in the studio to then overlay on drums for Michael Jackson's music or something like that. So it's just something that I always kind of like, I'm always interested in going, what's the really craziest thing? Sample packs. So you've been very successful.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of your peers kind of wax lyrical about them. How do you even begin to kind of start a pack when, like, knowing your breadth and depth of hip hop and the different subgenres and all that? How do you even start a pack to cater to every, to all this kind of, to the whole breadth of hip hop?
Well, I guess it's kind of just happened naturally over the years. Like, I mean, the last two kits I did were very much specifically in that kind of like Griselda kind of the darker kind of hip hop vibe. But I guess previously my whole idea was, you know, like a lot of the kits were, because I didn't see anybody catering to things like across the board. Right. Everybody has this kind, you know, there's a lot, you know how it is, man. There's a lot of kind of segregation between different factions and different subgenres, let's say, within the genre. And I guess as a fan of just like style, I just like different styles, you know what I'm saying? And I guess I wanted to make kits that kind of like were a representation of who I am as a producer and what I would like to hear in a kit, you know what I mean? So over the years, I've just like, I guess, you know, I also noticed that a lot of people don't really put a lot of sounds in their stuff. So I just would make sure that the kits were just full of like stuff, only like no filler, just stuff that you would want to use in the kit. So if you wanted to say like, if you literally had nothing, no like plugins or anything, you just had a DAW or you had an MP or whatever, you could pull up my kit and you can make a beat strictly out of the kit. You know what I mean? But I mean the whole kit thing anyway, it kind of came out of necessity anyway, because I was doing the trips to the States. I was doing like three trips a year, like two weeks to a month, like every time, and obviously that's pricey, so any way that I could try and make money, I would. And then this guy Alcota, who runs the drum broker, he had interviewed me for his blog, and he had talked about like him like starting a site, and was I interested in doing a kit? So I guess I was one of the first ones on his site. So I've been blessed enough to keep that relationship up, and you know, it's just grown from there, really. Do you know what I mean? I feel like when the years where I was kind of a bit quiet, for whatever reason, like the kits kind of kept my kept me like paid, and also kept my name out there. Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of people just mostly know me from the kits. Well, maybe not as much now, but like previously, a lot of people just were really, really knew me from the kits.
Yeah. So it's when I speak to my producer friends, and I've got a bit of a confession to make. I think some of my albums or many of them are filled with your drums. I'm pretty sure. Cause
I think so too, because you work with Parky Heavy, right?
You see, there we go. Shout out to Michael Parky.
That's why Parky's drums sound so tough. That's why.
But he's got, you know, he's got
MP and all that.
So your drums are all over my projects. But I'm not a producer, but when I listen to any kind of beat from any producer, I'm always drawn to drums. I think that's the hook for me. Like, who are some of the producers whose drums you really, really like?
Shit, bro. I mean, it really depends. Over the years, it's changed a lot. I think, I think Jake One's drum programming is sick. I think he's really good. You know, I think people's styles have changed over the years, man. You know what I mean? Like, so it's hard to really say. Like, I don't think anybody's really still got. I tell you who's got sick drum programming. Knotts has got great drum programming as well. High Tech as well. I mean, there's a certain era of Havoc as well, where like he really had his own kind of sound. I don't know, man.
I'm not a producer, but the drums I'm drawn to, like, you know, because I'm in a time warp, I can't help it. I'm drawn to like Premiere, Ninth Wonder, Black Milk.
I love Black Milk.
I think Bink is really good at the drum programming as well.
He's a drummer, so I can hear it.
Let's talk about you moving from the UK to the US. Yeah. Now, you mentioned taking trips in between. Yeah. What was the preparation and planning like? And what was the moment when you realized, okay, listen, the trips aren't going to cut anymore. I've got to move over there. Like, what position were you in your mind, and what did you have to do to make that move?
I mean, I think from the start of me trying to kind of do stuff in the States, it was always my kind of idea to move to the States. But obviously, you know, immigration in this country, or just immigration in general, is tricky. So kind of figuring out how to do that was a kind of long process, you know what I mean? But I guess like the first person I really saw that was kind of doing a lot of that, actually moved to the States, that I knew was Snips.
Yeah.
DJ Snips. And I guess like seeing him do, like be in the States and get that O-1 visa or whatever, it kind of made me think, okay, well, man, like, I feel like this is obtainable, because this is a guy that I've been around, you know what I'm saying? This is a guy I know, like, you know, but you know, life gets in the way and stuff, and it you know, obviously it's expensive too, you know, you have to pay an immigration lawyer and all that kind of stuff. And I guess, you know, it's tricky as well, if you know, because like you have to prove that you're, you know, making money off of, you know, in the official kind of ways. And like, I guess at that point, at the beginning of me working out there, I was really predominantly making money off of selling beats to people that weren't really known. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then the drum kits, like in the early 2010s. So, I mean, the process really, I guess, the thing that really made me think, okay, I need to move to LA, was I did a trip with like my boys from New York to LA in 2014. And off of a session I did then, I basically, like, Dre cut a record. And like that week also was so inspirational, because the amount of stuff I got done in that week was kind of more than I was getting done in the three trips to New York so, every year, you know what I mean? So I kind of was like, and you know, obviously, like, the Dre record never came out, but that was kind of the turning point, the tipping point of like, oh, you know what, if I'm out there, I definitely am going to get, you know, that happened in a week. If I go out there, I'm definitely going to be able to, you know, make some shit happen. And at the time, I already kind of had things kind of bubbling a little bit, you know. We had a few things. There was a few things I already knew were in the works, like, for instance, the Jadakiss record. And, you know, I'd already kind of worked a lot on the mixtape circuit. So I knew that, like, big rappers would like my stuff. It's just, I just didn't know how I was gonna put that into effect. Let's say, you know, moving out here. So then I called an immigration lawyer in, I think it was the end of like 2014, or might have been sometime in 2015. And one of those years anyway. And it turned out that I was eligible for a green card, so.
All you had to do was just pull up the Discogs page on the immigration line and say, look, man. I produce for Dr. Dre, you know, fam. Like, sort this thing out, innit? That's what I would have done.
We see that thing, that Dre song didn't come out. Like, that was kind of like...
Pull it up. I say, listen, bruv, look, that's Dr. Dre, yeah? That's Andre Young. Yeah, sign the paper, man.
Innit? Yeah, don't mess up my growth, bruv.
That's what I would have done. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry to cut you.
Basically, you know, it was a long process. It took like about 3 years, and then And then it was even a thing, because like when I got my green card, it was like when it was approved, it was like just when Trump came in, and they definitely, like, you know, it definitely got a bit more strict. So my interview was horrible, man. It was horrible. I knew something was wrong, because the guy just looked at me and was like he just looked at me like, you know, who are you? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was like one of them airport shows where they bring you into the room and thing.
Yes, yeah, it was exactly like, exactly like that. And you know, I don't know, man. I could just tell that I was getting judged. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I didn't hear back for about like, you're meant to hear back within 10 days of the thing. But I didn't hear back for like 3 months.
Wow.
And then I find out just by like, basically just checking their site. One day I was like, I'd given up. I thought, I've been denied. And I looked on the site and it said, you know, approved. And you have to be in the country by, I think it was like the 16th of January or something. So that was like December the 18th or something stupid like that. I don't know what it was, but it was less than a month. I was like, oh, shit. Gotta get my stuff together. But, man, I'm here, you know what I'm saying? And it's been amazing being over here, bro. Like, things have definitely been put in the slipstream, you know what I'm saying? Things have just gotten a lot quicker. And it's just not, you know, people take you a lot more seriously being out here as a, you know, like, as opposed to the guy that visits from over there, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The fact that I can pull up on people and, you know what I mean? There's a lot less shadiness because of that as well, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People don't hide behind. Hide. You know? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. How did you meet Mike, the manager?
So, like, me and Ant-Man Wonder were cool, and he was being looked after by Mike, and this is like the year before I moved out. Maybe, yeah, it was like the end of 2016.
Right.
Ant, I guess, had put him onto me, and I just got a message randomly in my email, and you know, from him at Shady, and he just basically was like, "Yeah, I'm interested in talking to you, man. Can you call me?" And then we talked, and he was like, "Yeah, I want to manage you, man. Can we sort it out?" And of course, like, I'd been burnt quite a few times randomly, right. And so I was a bit dubious about it. But man, it's been good, man. The more that I've got going on, the more that he can help me. Really, that's, you know, it's been good.
Yeah, Mike's
good. And he's a legend. You know what I mean? Like, exec producer on the bigger picture. You know, been in the game for a long time. You know what I mean?
No, he's good peoples.
Even comes from a producer world himself. You know,
yeah, he did a couple of Screwball records. I remember.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Cool G Rap records too, right?
Yeah.
The album on Raucous. I think he ain't know that even.
Wow, we need to get him on the podcast.
I asked him.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Right, he heard me.
Look at the flex. I asked him.
I asked him. He heard me. It's fine. I had to send him some stuff from back in the day. And I said, I said, I met Mike when we did the Joel Ortiz show, Joel's first tour here.
He used to manage Joel too.
Right. So I met him here. So I found my old hard drive with a bunch of old footage, like B-roll, like from the show, running around Manchester, London, all that. So I sent that to him and I said, look, I've got this. He said, oh, cool, send it to me. And then as I sent, I said, look, man, it'd be great to have you on the podcast. It was like, yeah, thanks for sending this. But I'm not going to stress Mike because I'm not stressing him. Like, Mike will do what he wants to do. You know what I mean?
I'll mention it to him still.
Yeah, mention it to him, but don't stress. Mike will do what he wants to do. If he wants to do it, he'll do it. If he don't want to do it, he won't do it. It's I know him enough in that way to know. Right, so I've got to ask you about the time or the day you met Prodigy in the studio, that first time. Because that must have been
great. Oh, man, that was great. You know what? This story involves Jameson as well.
Oh, that's me. You see what I mean? My guy, love him.
This is a good one, man. This is a good one. So me and Jameson have been out drinking, and J-Mo can't really, like, Jameson can't really, like, hold his drink that well.
That's a lie.
He can't. I've seen him as well.
Really?
You can't, bro.
I don't know. I'm definitely a heavy drinker. But
when I see him at Christmas, bro, like he holds it down now. Like, I'm the one who's and all that.
Well, I don't know at the time. Yeah. But anyway, we were hanging out a lot because I was in the States. I was in New York. Like, I was doing this thing where you go to the States for under 3 months or whatever, and to 2011, I was over there a lot. And me and him was hanging out and we went drinking. And I guess he wasn't too well. He wasn't too well. So I took him in a taxi. I took him home in a taxi. I made sure he was okay in the, when he was living in the Bronx or whatever.
Oh, yeah, that place. Oh, Jesus.
And
the hood. He lives in the hood.
Bro. Yeah, he definitely did. But here's the thing. So as I was getting out, I must have, like, had my passport and my money in the same like wallet thing. And I must have, like, paid the guy, like, as I was kind of, like, helping him out. Like, I put the wallet on the chair because it was one of those, like, you know, the big, like, taxi trucks.
Right.
Truck, but, like, yeah.
The big ones. Yeah.
Like, the big ones, anyway. So I put the passport or the wallet on the side, closed the door. And as the thing went off, I was like, oh, shit. So I, like, kind of, like, ran after it. And then I was like, oh, shit, I don't know what to do. So, like, I literally had, like, what? I want to say, like, $100 on me or something. Anyway, I like made sure like Jameson was all right, got him back, jumped on the train. And then, I guess the next day, I was kind of like fucked up. I didn't really know what to do. So, I was staying between my boy Arm's couch in Harlem and like my boy in Ronin in Flatbush.
Right.
So I couldn't stay in Harlem that day. So I had to jump on the train and go to link Ronin somewhere. And he told me that he was going to be at the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival.
Right.
So I went down there. I was like really feeling sorry for myself, man. I was hungover. I was like, oh man. And I just felt terrible for like getting Jameson in that state too, you know what I'm saying? Like I was egging him on to drink, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was really like, yeah, let's drink more. And he's like, yeah,
you know what I mean? But he's like that now. You should see him now. Yeah. He's you. Yeah.
Bro, it's crazy. No, it's nuts though. So, I bumped into my boy Nez, Lord Nez, who I hadn't seen in a long time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, Lord Nez basically was like, yo, Butcher, like Prodigy's been talking about you like a lot. And I'd been hearing through the like, because I had done stuff with Yayo.
Right.
And Yayo would told me that he'd been working out to the tape that we did. You know what I mean? We did a tape where I did like 7 out of 10 tracks on the tape.
Yeah.
Called El Chapo. And so anyway, like Nez says, you know, oh, Prodigy's been talking about you. I'm going to go there now. Do you want to come with me? I said, yeah, but I don't really have any money, bro. Like, I don't really know how I'm going to get back. You know what I mean? Like, no, it wasn't that I didn't know how I was going to get back, but it was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, right. I need food. I can't, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't really know what to do. He's like, no, I got you, bro. I got an EBT card. I've got that. He's like, yeah, my boy can drive us. I'm like, my boy's here. He'll drive us. So we caught a ride down there, and it was like the minute I walked through the door, man, it was like I came home, bro. It was weird. I like saw all sorts of people that I knew from like networking on like MySpace and, you know, via other things, because I was like a huge Mobb Deep fan and a huge like G-Unit fan. So, and at that point, the G-Unit like entourage and the Mobb Deep entourage were kind of like, they were merged. Because that's how I even got with Tony Yayo, is like a dude that was down with both Mobb and G-Unit or whatever. So, I seen these guys and they were like, and everyone was like, oh shit, Beat Butcher. And I was like, oh. And Prodigy literally comes up and is like, yo, bro, like, I love your music. I was like, oh my God, like, what the hell? Like, this is sick. Yeah, man, it was just dope, man. The energy was all the way up. And I guess, like, you know, within the first, it was like the first, like, 3 beats or whatever, they all got recorded. And those became, Dead Man's Shoes, Skull and Bones, and I can't remember what the other joint was. But, yeah, they basically all got recorded, the first 3 tracks that I played.
Right, okay.
It was dope, man. It was Prodigy's, like, probably... Well, at this point, I think he's my favorite rapper of all time, bro. So, like, you know.
Mm. I want to big you up for the beat you did for them, Timeless.
Yeah, yeah, thank you, man. Thanks.
Crazy, crazy. And I just feel it's kind of almost like something spiritual about it, that it was the last Mobb Deep album as well, even though we didn't know it at mm-hmm. the time. It was when I heard it, I was like, yeah, this is, it was almost like the old and the new met right in the middle. I love that track, so big up for that one.
Thanks, bro. Yeah, that's probably one of my favourite ones I did with them.
Yeah, I love that song. Rest in peace to Prodigy, though, because we love him too.
Absolutely.
We love him.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely, man. Love to Prodigy, love to his family and stuff, you know what I mean?
You probably can tell, though, I like a bit of a giggle and I like a laugh, man. I don't take things very seriously. So I've got to talk about Sean Price because I think his humour is notorious.
Absolutely.
Any funny memories about the legendary Sean Price?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I have like a bunch of stories. I mean, we hung out a shitload, man. Like, I used to go to his apartment in Brownsville, and you know, like he liked a little party. He used to have a little party in his kitchen every time that anytime, you know what I mean? It'd be like a little drink, a little smoke or whatever, and playing beats and playing his own songs, the same songs over and over again, and stop in the bar and go, "Whoo, I'm nice."
I miss it.
There was definitely some awkward situations. I remember the first time I went over there, I was sat in his, because he had a computer in his bedroom, and I sat there with him, and we were like, going through beats and like sipping with his wife, and his boy who just came home turned up, and this dude was like, he was like a Puerto Rican 5%er, yeah. I don't know, man. He was intense, bro. He was like staring me down from the corner. He was staring me down from the corner, and he was like telling all these stories about how he cut people
Yo.
he wasn't talking to me, though. He was talking to Sean, but he was looking at me. Sean is fucking weird. I just remember thinking, yo, this is weird. And also, like, there was hugely, like, it was a lot of irony in it, because the dude was very light. He was like as light as me. And he was chatting about, you know, white devil, all this shit. And I was like, I'm pretty sure you got like white people in your family. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was nuts, bro. I just remember sitting there looking at him like, yo, like.
That's nuts. That's a quick, you know what though? I just have to laugh though, because that just seems like, I never knew Sean Price, obviously, but that just sounds like a regular day in the Sean Price household.
I have to say something now. It's a bit of a. So you went to the house, Butcher.
Yeah, a bunch
Ronan,
of times.
Ronan, when I used to go to New York, Ronan would always say to me, "Do you want me to take you to Sean Price's house?"
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd be like, "Brownsville? Yeah. Maybe next time. And now I regret it, because he was like, "You know, you I'll get you the pass. I'll get you the pass." I was like, I'm a brown dude from like Southall. Like, what am I going to do, right?
You would have been fine, bro.
At the time, I was just like, I kept putting it off. And now it's obviously...
Yeah, you know, and definitely, I mean, I don't know whether it's more rough or less rough right now, but I feel like it might have been more rough in like 2009 than it... You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Definitely less gentrification and all that kind of stuff. But it was, you know... I don't know, it's weird. It's like, because of where I've been staying over there, you know, at the time, I stayed in like Wakefield in the Bronx in like my boy's apartment, slept on the floor there. And then also like, I forget what fucking projects it is, but somewhere on the East in Harlem. And
right.
So I kind of like, I don't know, man. It wasn't, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't something I wasn't like familiar with, if you know what I mean. So, so it was kind of like going down there. Yeah, of course, Brownsville is Brownsville at the end of the day, but still, it was like, it wasn't like I didn't have any problems. I hadn't had anybody like really. It was just literally when I was sat in Sean Price's crib that one day, and that dude had come home, and he was, I don't know who the hell he was, yeah, but he was intense. I'm telling you, he was intense. He was definitely looking at, like, he was definitely like, you know, mean mugging. And
That's a hilarious story, though. That's a
rest
hilarious
in peace,
story.
Rest in peace, Sean Price. I really miss that guy. It's crazy you can miss someone.
I do have a good story, actually. No, it was funny. We went, so we linked up in Amsterdam. So my mum lives in the Netherlands, and so I'd moved before I decided to focus on doing stuff in the States. I was like, okay, cool. Well, if I move to the Netherlands, like maybe I can save some money. I can move in with my mum. I can save a bit of money, and then I can like try and get my right. things sorted. So anyway, this is around the time that me and Sean Price first like linked up. I want to say it's like 2009. And he's like, oh yeah, no, bro, link up. He was doing a video with this guy, Red Light Boogie, Sugarcane, and in Amsterdam. So, and I was with this dude Rotjoch, who's a TV presenter over there, and I like had done like some session with my boy, and I just decided, fuck it, I'm a roll with him because he was going over there, so I said I'll roll with him. And we just caused havoc in the studio, man. It was just like, it was just disrespectful, bro. Me and him were just so drunk. Bro, I swear to this day, there's still dudes that I like bump into from that day that I think I'm a complete arsehole.
Wow.
Fast forwarding, Duckworth, the new project, right? You're all over. Yes, how did you guys connect with?
My friend Narsen, who I produced the record with, he Ty, who's Brent Fires' manager, had told him about this guy, Duckworth, and said, yo, you need to do a session. And I was actually meant to do, I was with Griselda. Yeah, so I was meant to like turn up at the session with him, but instead I just sent him a folder of stuff, and that was that composition was one of the compositions that was in there. And I looked him up and I was like, whoa, he's dope. He's really dope. Like, it was exciting. I couldn't be at the session because I think I was with Griselda. I was with Griselda at the time, and I believe they were recording, what were they recording at the time? I think it was George Bondo. That's right. I think it was the day that was recorded. So I wasn't able to be there. But yeah, man, I was just super chuffed the way it turned out, bro. Like, he's really on the rise. It's probably one of my favorite songs that I've produced like recently. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I ended up doing a bit of post-production on it too. Like, I added a bunch of change-ups, and then that interlude, like I kind of that made that music kind of from scratch, still with the same kind of vibe in mind or whatever. But yeah, man, Duckworth's on the rise, man. That great dude, man. Yep. Yeah. Hopefully do more stuff with him.
When did you find out that you had made it to the Everything Is Love album?
Oh, it was very last minute, man. Super last. I knew they cut the record because I kind of like read between the lines of the cryptic message that I was getting from Cool. But I knew that they'd cut because they'd asked for like stems, and I knew that they were working on that. And then it was like, you know, oh yeah, somebody very big's cut to this track. And I was like, I know who you're in with type shit. Anyway, yeah, it was maybe like 2 days before it came out. I'm still a bit upset that it was a bonus cut though, man, because it's a fire.
Remind me
of posters and stuff. So.
Yeah, remind me at the end of the interview. I'll talk to you about something about that, but carry on.
Carry on. Nah, so yeah, it was last minute, man, and then I don't know, it was maybe like 2 days before, and I don't know, like it's not a huge crazy story about it. Weird though, because the music on that, I did the music on that like during the period, like literally. It's weird how it all happened. It was like almost like the period that I gave up on. I thought I wasn't getting the green card. So So I kind of had this really productive moment. It was almost like a really weird thing where it was like, oh, there's no pressure on me anymore. So I had this really productive moment. And I like created that. The beat for, I don't know if you heard the Dave East Wanna Be a G with Max V. I made that beat.
Yeah, I've heard that.
During that time. What else did I make? I made, there was a few things that, like the sample from the Party Next Door record.
Oh, wow.
All in that time, like, in that little period, yeah.
Butcher was going out with a bang. He said, "Listen, mate, they're not letting me in the country, man. I'm gonna let them remember me."
No, well, my thing was just like, I just thought, you know what? Okay, I'm gonna have to think of a different plan. And then I've suddenly thought of all this like different things I could be doing. I was just like, oh, well, I could go traveling and just make music and go traveling. And I was like, oh, it's a euphoric place, you know, like the world's your oyster, except for that. You know, except for the movie, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's like a lot of pressure, bro. Because like, you put all this money into it, you know, there's a lot of money to move out here. You know what I'm saying? So
let's shift back to the UK real quick. Mm. Talk about, there's someone in terms of the UK music scene, someone who I got a lot of love for, and I don't think he gets his just due, Chemo.
Yes.
Tell me about your relationship with Chemo, and Chemo being probably one of the greatest musical minds walking the earth somewhere.
My relationship with Chemo, bro. Like, I love Chemo, man. He's a great dude, man. It's funny, like, we've known each other a long time, man. I want to say since, like, 99 or something like that. I don't know. We just hit it off straight away the first time I ever met him. Like, I got... this is going to sound so nerdy. I know him from an internet forum.
It's all good, man. It's all good. It's all good.
Tell
a story. Go ahead.
Yeah, and bro, it makes me even more nerdy because internet forums in 99, bro. Like, who was on an internet forum in 99?
Yeah, you know, were different. But you're producers, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny because, like, I know there's a lot of people that I know from those days. And I guess... Rap 6 from Paragon had flown, like, at the time I was living in the Netherlands, like, I'd moved back to my mum's when I was 16, and I guess I was about 18 at the time, and so it must have been 2000, actually, thinking about it, and we just decided one day that we was going to go and link Chemo. At the time, he was called Mad Squirrel.
Okay, because they had the he had the project Squirrels with Guns. Mm-hmm. Chemo's different. Chemo's weird, but I love him for that. Yeah. I love him for that.
I think that's why we get on, because we've got a weird sense of humor. Like that same. So anyway, that same day, I guess Raps, like, you know, he had some stuff to do, so I was like, oh, yo, do you mind if I go link up with you know, Dave again, go meet up with him in Streatham or whatever, and yeah, it was a funny night, bro. Like, we got completely plastered and wore like tennis rackets on our heads, and like, over the years we've kind of like had this thing where we just end up like recording weird parody songs, and like, so, and as like we've musically kind of like moved away from each other, like we might not be like working on serious music together. We like, anytime we get together, it's always a joke, man. It's always love. It's always fucking.
No, Chemo is a good guy. And I often say, as an artist, a lot of us wouldn't sound as good as we do without someone like Chemo being in.
Yeah, he's definitely was the backbone of like a certain period of the scene, and he still is to a degree. You know, definitely. I mean, like, mixing all the stuff that he's mixing, and because I believe he mixes a lot of the high focus stuff too.
He does, still. Yeah, he does. Yeah. He does. Let's talk about Children of Zeus. I was really excited to hear what you did with them on the last album. You had two production credits. Question is this: when are we getting the Beat Butcher Children of Zeus project?
It's coming. We haven't really, like, they're trying to do the album, their next album first, which is almost done. I think it's like 90% there. I've got a bunch of like co-production and production credit on there. But yeah, that's the next thing after they do that. We still got to figure out, like, you know, I guess it'd be the same thing. We'll make the music first and then we'll figure it out, like figure out what we're going to call it. And it was what was kind of word that maybe we would build a super group. So it's like almost like a you know, call it something else. It's like Children of Zeus, and you know, like how No Worries is, you know, a different name or whatever. Yeah. But plus, I'm kind of working on this little alias thing as well, so it might tie in more with the sound of the alias than of Beat Butcher, if you know what I mean.
Gotcha. Jest. Yeah. You produced for Jest.
Yeah.
One of my favorite songs that you've produced, and you know, I know you're a way better producer now, but I'm the actual factual. I like the old stuff. So I love I Don't Wanna Be Here, Michael Parkinson. I love What Happened to the World, Sha Stimuli.
Yeah.
One of the ones I love from you the most is England, that you did for Jest. But what I've always wanted to ask you is, why was it recorded that way, like almost like a demo, and you can hear it, like Jest's vocals are very rough, almost like he recorded them through the earphones or something. Like, can you explain that session for me?
Well, when me, like, yeah, it's a bit of me and Jess used to live together, and that basically the story behind that song is like that he had that beat for ages. I used to give him these like these fucking 30, 40 beat tapes, and he'd written that song quite some time before we even recorded it, but. Like I would, every time that he would spit it, I would be like, "Yo, bro, you gotta record that. You've gotta record that." So then, around the time that we like, he moved in with me, like there was something going on that day, and it was like, "Oh, let me just quickly lay down this verse on your mic." He basically, it was one of the only songs I think I've ever really recorded. That came out, and he recorded it in my bedroom, basically. And yeah, bro, it was weird because we revisited it when it came time to, this was like 2005, I think. And when it came time to like actually revisit it, he just couldn't get the same vibe. He couldn't, like, anytime he tried to re-record it, it just wouldn't have the same energy that had. So we kind of kept it in that way, and I guess he grimed it up even more. He kind of put this kind of like a megaphone kind of sound on over the original like a cappella that I gave him. And shit, that's basically how it turned out like that, man. It's weird because that song was a lot of years in the making, man. Like, that didn't come out until 2011. I want to say.
I'm going to say.
Yeah, it was the year of the riots. That was 2011,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so that's why the message was so timely. Yep, you're right.
Right, but everybody thought that he'd written it at that time, you know what I'm saying? But actually, it's weird because the lyrics came from like conversations that me and him used to have. Like, anybody that knows Jess knows that he can talk. I can talk as well. I just fucking blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm saying? But me and him together, we just talk fucking for hours about random shit and complain about everything, you know, grumpy old man business. And I guess the lyrics to that song came out of some of the things that we were talking about at the time.
Yeah.
Because I think before that he was living at a different, we were living not too far from each other, but I'd go and see him over there, and like, we'd just be like, we were both in kind of like stressful situations and
right.
Yeah, so yeah, there was a lot of complaining. It wasn't too, you know, he says, he talked about a baby down a trash chute in Catford or whatever.
Yeah, so racist with ice picks in Catford. A baby got disposed of in Catford. That sounds crazy.
Yeah. That was actually something that happened.
Yeah,
that was actually something that happened, and that was in the. I remember like having that conversation with him about that.
I actually
in the news and stuff, and because at the time we were both living in Lewisham. So.
Yeah, I remember being in. Funny, I remember being in the studio the day he cut, thinking crazy.
Yeah,
with, Mr. Thing, thinking, right, I'm official. Like, I'm hearing all this stuff. I do remember that time. But I love that record. I think it's dope.
He's a legend, man. He's I would consider him one of my best friends, man. He's a fucking great dude.
And he's, you know, he's mad humble. I remember I was recording a song with Parky, and he just popped up to the studio one day. So I'm thinking, oh man, I got to record this song with Jest, man. Yeah. And I did the verse, and Jest was like, nah, perfect, one take. I said, yes. The UK scene, you've put a lot of work in. I'm talking names, man. M9, Triple Darkness, Manage, all these people. The scene is now flourishing and it's bigger than it's ever been. How does it look to you from that side of the pond, and how do you feel about it?
It's great, man. It's great to see some money floating about as well. You know, and not everything's about money, but like if we want to, you know, if you want to encourage people to keep creating, like there's got to be an incentive for it to a degree. Like people have got to be able to feed themselves. So it's nice to see that. It's also nice to see that like the influence of some of the styles that we've got are influencing, you know, like American music. You know, it's dope, man. It feels like some of the more exciting stuff, like within a certain like sound, is in the UK. Do you know what I'm saying? Because it's just that like we're known for like mixing genres, really, aren't we? Like we're known for like putting our own spin on things, and I think it's dope, man. It's also dope to hear like, you know, people know, like people out here. And there was a point when I used to come out like early on where people used to clown, you know, European rap of any sort, like, you know what I'm saying? And especially the UK stuff, because there was this whole thing of like, you know, oh, tea and crumpets, the queen, blah, blah, blah. So it's nice to know that people are a bit more switched on to what the culture is really about over there, and like that things aren't just a certain, you know, just however we get portrayed in films or whatever. And that people actually take our music seriously, that not just the rock stuff, and not, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. they actually take
like, you know, black music seriously from the UK or whatever. But yeah, I'm proud of it, bro. I've got to be honest, man. I'm proud of it. I'm not really working with a huge amount of people over there, but you know, I definitely listen to some of the drill stuff. You know, like Children of Zeus are probably one of my favorite groups as well.
Yeah, me too.
I think what else, like who else I can shout out that I think is really dope. There's a lot of really cool stuff, man.
Yeah.
I definitely, especially like with the drill stuff, but like, I just like the way that style is like pushing like production forward a little bit. You know what I mean? It might not be the most productive thing in terms of what people are talking about, you know what I'm saying? But at the end of the day, it's expression, but like that, the beats, I got to say, some of those beats, like when I hear Nux or somebody like that, like I just love the way he's kind of incorporating elements of like, you know, this like jazzy samples with like that kind of drum programming. Mm-hmm. It's dope, man. It's inspirational. Like I feel like over here, there's like a, you know, there's a lot of people that are like pushing the boundaries and stuff, but the way that I think that British music pushes boundaries is kind of different. We're more ballsy with it in some sort of way. You know what I mean? We dare to experiment more. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Mr. Summit, over to you, my man.
I'm good. I'm good. This has been a good conversation for me. I've kind of realized while listening to Butcher speaking, he may not like me saying this, but you're a deep brother, you know. Like you're very insightful in terms of like.
What's wrong with this guy?
Nah, but it's true. Like, listen. The way in which you talk about your art, your artistry, and then how you just, you talked about how grumpy old men, and like, but it's really about like you have a perspective on things, and that comes through. And so more than anything, about any of these interviews we want to do, we want to learn and we want to gain new perspective. But you open my eyes and my head up to new perspectives. But thank you for that. And I'll just reiterate what I said at the beginning, that I'm really, really proud and really happy to see you flourish. I know you've got stuff coming. We know you're going to keep going higher and higher, and it's just sky's the limit, you know? So thank you for all you've done for the scene here. Thank you for your time.
And thanks for having me on. Yeah.
Yeah, man. And the music, man. Come on, man. You're, and for a lot of the kids growing up now, like, you know how we would say like a Mike Geronimo was a soundtrack when we were growing up, or OC.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Like, you got to understand that the music you're creating now for kids growing up is a soundtrack of what they were growing up on. So in 10, 15 years time, they'd be like, yo, they want to interview so bad. And like, it's a great thing that you're part of a culture and you're contributing so much. And what we want to do is celebrate that.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. It's a blessing to be able to contribute still. Do you know what I mean? I've been making music for like 20 years, bro. So hopefully I got another fucking 30, 40 years of me. You know what I'm saying?
You have, man. You have. But blessings and good luck with everything. And thanks for the time, bro.
Thank you, bro. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care, man.
There you have it. Another episode done. Listen, I ain't gonna say too much. I keep talking. Chris.
Do you know what I want to say though? Yeah. I feel very privileged and blessed that we were able to talk to Beat Butcher. A lot of the people we've spoken to are absolutely certified legends. And so is Beat Butcher, but he's very much in his prime, and we're witnessing his ascent in real time. So it's not going to be one of those things where, you know, coming up, people had to tell me about Public Enemy or Schoolie D. I can talk about Beat Butcher in real time. I can tell my kids if I ever have them. I say, yeah, man, there was a guy called Beat Butcher. He was a really good producer, and I spoke to him on my podcast back in the day. You know,
it's really
dope. And I love to see hardworking but good people win. It's encouraging.
100%. So yeah, no, this is a good moment for us, and I think his success will continue onwards and upwards. And he will be a shining light to young producers coming out there, current producers out there, as a almost like a role model of such to go, this is what you could do with hard work. Like, I always look at things in footballing terms. It's no different to Ronaldo, who's got talent, but worked so hard to be the best footballer of all time. Right?
Was Ronaldo the ugly one?
No, don't say that, bro.
Was he the one with the long hair?
Yo. I'm ignoring that. We're talking about Cristiano Ronaldo, right?
Oh, okay. All right. Now he's different. He's the guy them sugar. Who's the other one?
Man,
it's not Ronaldinho. Is it Ronaldinho?
You're talking about Ronaldinho. That's rude.
Bro. Yeah, yeah.
That's rude, bro. You're rude. I ain't saying that. All I'm saying is, Butcher is a testament to those who work hard and have good talent. Chris has lost it at this point. Shit, he lost it.
I'm sorry.
But no, honestly, love to Butcher as always. And I'm sure we'll speak to him soon in the near future. But as always, social at Break the Atoms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Let us know what you think. Make sure you share and leave us your feedback as well, not just on DMs. But he's gone.
I just remembered it again.
He's gone. Leave us your feedback, not on just DMs and emails. Leave us your feedback on Apple. Raise awareness of the podcast. We'll be back again next week with yet another interview. Until then, peace.